You could win an audio DVD of every presentation from all six Issues Etc. Making the Case conferences. Record your answer to the question, Issues Etc. What does this mean? On our comment line, 618-223-8382. If we play your answer during Issues Etc., we'll send you a conference audio DVD of almost 50 hours of teaching. 618-223-8382 and answer the question, Issues Etc., what does this mean? Please be sure to mention where you listen.
My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written, informed by history and tradition and precedent. Tomorrow, I begin meeting with members of the Senate, which plays an essential role in this process. I will tell each senator that I revere the Constitution. I believe that an independent judiciary is the crown jewel of our constitutional republic. If confirmed by the Senate, I will keep an open mind in every case, and I will always strive to preserve the Constitution of the United States and the American rule of law. Thank you, Mr. President.
That's U.S. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh speaking Monday after President Donald Trump announced that he would be his choice to fill Anthony Kennedy's space on the U.S. Supreme Court. There's a lot of speculation as to what that means, and there was a lot of speculation before the choice was made about who it would be. It didn't turn out to be the one that everyone was focusing on, but some are saying really doesn't make any difference. It's going to be just as good. What is the judicial philosophy of U.S. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh? Joining us to answer that question on this Thursday afternoon, David French. He's a regular guest. He's constitutional law attorney. Previously served as senior counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice for the Alliance Defending Freedom, and he's senior writer at National Review. David, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
In a recent piece in the Washington Post, you called the choice of Brett Kavanaugh perhaps a bit of a missed opportunity. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I think Brett Kavanaugh is a very good choice. I think he'll be a very good Supreme Court justice with an opportunity to be an excellent Supreme Court justice. But I thought that there was a better candidate available, and I thought that it was Amy Coney Barrett, Seventh Circuit judge, former Notre Dame law professor. Sterling originalist credentials, sterling academic credentials, and a person who had come under fire in her previous confirmation hearing based on her religious faith. And I thought this was an opportunity not just to put an originalist justice on the court, somebody who would be rock solid in applying originalist principles and interpreting the Constitution, but also elevating a person who could deeply, deeply connect with millions of Christian Americans, and also an opportunity to break the Ivy League logjam on the Supreme Court. Everyone's from Harvard or Yale, and it could have been an opportunity to break that logjam. And so I think that that's not a criticism of Brett Kavanaugh. It's a compliment to Amy Barrett. As I said, I think Brett Kavanaugh is a good choice, and he richly deserves confirmation.
There was a time not so long ago, really not so long ago at all, when social conservatives would have been delighted just to see an improvement on the Supreme Court. We're really talking about a major difference here. How confident are you that Brett Kavanaugh will be that major difference that so many have suddenly begun to realize is possible?
I think he'll be a significant difference. The question is, of course, going to be how significant, and we won't know for years. But one of the reasons why we're confident that Brett Kavanaugh will make a significant positive difference on the court is that he has a clearly articulated judicial philosophy and a clearly visible record of judicial decision making that I think should encourage people to believe that the court is going to move into a more originalist direction. And I think that that's a welcome change. It's an overdue change, considering how many swings and misses there have been in the past from Republican presidents and their attempts to appoint high-quality originalist justices to the court. I feel very comfortable in saying that we will see a significant improvement in the jurisprudence of the court. It will move in a more originalist direction. We'll just have to reconvene about 10 years and see how big of a difference he made.
Speaking of making differences, I want you to talk a little bit about this group that has only recently come into probably popular focus. That is the Federalist Society and the influence it has had for the last two decades on the federal courts.
Yeah, the Federalist Society is one of the more impactful and visionary organizations in the entire United States. Founded more than 30 years ago, still not that old of an organization, and really came into its own in this new century. And essentially what it has done is it's created not just a community of conservative legal scholars, but also it's also really enhanced the legal academy. So the Federalist Society has chapters at law schools across the country, provides a place for more libertarian-minded or originalist-minded young lawyers to gather, to hear ideas, to engage in debates with peers, to bring scholars to campus to debate, and then to create an enduring network after they graduate. And one of the reasons why this has been so visionary is that the left had a long time network of reliable, highly credentialed progressives to pick from, and that was based in the legal academy. The legal academy was reliably and relentlessly producing very high quality progressive candidates. Because the legal academy is essentially run by progressives, conservatives had to create other institutions to help nurture originalist and libertarian legal talent. And that's what they did. And they've nurtured that legal talent. They have provided avenues for that legal talent to succeed professionally. And then now, ultimately, that legal talent is ending up on the nation's highest court and is ending up on district and federal circuit courts around the country.
So let's talk about the judicial philosophy of nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Beginning with the issue of life, what do we know from his record on his philosophy there?
Well, we don't know a lot. He's had a recent case, a Garza case, where he noted that the federal government had an interest in protecting fetal life and should not be required to facilitate access to abortion. But one of the interesting things about Kavanaugh is when you have a judge who's articulated in multiple cases across multiple disciplines a particular judicial philosophy, you can begin to predict, based on that judicial philosophy, the approach he'll take in other kinds of cases. And he is, by and large, what you would call an originalist judge. And as a result, originalist judges tend to be more hostile to Roe v. Wade and the cases that have been spawned by Roe v. Wade, because Roe v. Wade and cases that have been spawned by Roe v. Wade, like Planned Parenthood v. Casey, have little to nothing to do with the original public meaning of the Constitution. So I think it's pretty safe to say that Kavanaugh will be more suspicious of abortion rights claims, but it is not safe to say he will be so suspicious of abortion rights claims that he would vote to overturn Roe. We just don't know that.
In that vein, the Salt Lake City Tribune is reporting that Utah Senator Orrin Hatch met with Kavanaugh and at least at some point in their conversation emphasized that Roe v. Wade is, quote, settled opinion. What did he mean by that, and how likely is that kind of, pre-confirmation advice to influence a future judge on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, the phrase settled opinion, when it comes to the Supreme Court of the United States, is meaningless. So settled precedent is just sort of another term for long-standing precedent. There have been various times in the history of the Supreme Court where dreadful cases like Dred Scott were settled precedent. Plessy v. Ferguson was settled precedent. Settled precedent just simply means that it's been there a while. It hasn't been disturbed. That's all that it means. There's a huge difference between settled precedent and binding precedent. And on the Supreme Court, because it is the nation's highest court, is not really bound by precedent. It is a precedent-setting institution. Now, the doctrine of stare decisis, there's a lot of debate over, the precise contours, essentially says in the absence of manifest flaws, this court should, as a general matter, defer to precedent. But precedent does not bind the Supreme Court. So that phrase, settled precedent, is kind of a word, it's a weasel word, really, because it's a way of trying to tamp down speculation that he would overturn Roe without binding him to sustaining Roe. So it really tells us nothing important.
With regard to stare decisis, I've always kind of viewed that, and I'm not a lawyer, but I've always kind of viewed that as in baseball with the new umpire review, they always say, well, you can assume that this call on the play is going to stand absent overwhelming video evidence to the contrary. Is that kind of how it is?
I think stare decisis, I think that's a pretty good analogy. I think stare decisis is even less potent than that it's at the Supreme Court. It's essentially, I think what it is essentially that as a default matter, the court will defer to precedent. However, if there is a judgment of a majority of the court that prior precedent was wrong, it doesn't even have to be clearly wrong or unequivocally wrong or overwhelmingly wrong, that it was just wrong, then a majority of the court can and will and has many times in history voted to overturn it. And one thing that I would say is that there's a reason why the left is saying stare decisis, stare decisis, stare decisis when it comes to abortion. And that reason is that the language of Roe cannot be sustained by the Constitution of the United States. If you look at the actual Constitution of the United States, abortion, the right to abortion is nowhere protected in that document. And so that's why there's a constant emphasis on the actual Roe decision as opposed to the text of the Constitution. And that shows the vulnerability of that decision to judges who actually apply the history and text of the Constitution.
What do we know about Kavanaugh's views and his judicial philosophy regarding natural marriage?
Well, not a lot, really. I mean, I would suspect when it comes to how he would rule on the Supreme Court, I would just go ahead and say this. If you're thinking that Obergefell might be reversed by this court, just go ahead and drop that from your mind. It's difficult to perceive the kind of case that would actually come to the court and be taken up by the court that would potentially reverse Obergefell. I just don't think it's going to happen. I don't know of challenges to Obergefell that are heading up through the court system that are likely to be taken by the court. So I think on that position, I think it's much more fruitful and likely to fruitful to explore, because it's much more likely to happen, is what is this view going to be of free speech and religious liberty in the face of challenges rooted in non-discrimination laws, you know, advancing or protecting same-sex marriage. And I think that's where there's a lot of reason to believe he'll be quite protective of free speech, he'll be quite protective of religious liberty. But as far as anything that could overturn Obergefell, I don't think there's any indication from his jurisprudence or from the just practical realities of the court that that's going to happen or would be likely to happen.
So it sounds like you're saying Obergefell is going to have to stew for a while and the court is probably not going to hear anything. But with respect to the First Amendment, and in particular religious liberty, we got a better idea of where Kavanaugh stands.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's just as a practical matter, I would be willing to bet a large sum of money that the court would not even take a case to hear the case based on a challenge to the Obergefell precedent. But I would also be willing to say the court will take and will hear cases that are related to the clash between sexual liberty and religious liberty or sexual liberty and free speech.
You've written recently about what you've called the anti-Kavanaugh hysteria that's already in full bloom, as you say. What are you talking about, and how do you anticipate it will play out in the days approaching his confirmation before the U.S. Senate?
Well, it's just going to ramp up. So, you know, this is a guy who you're not going to be able to challenge on the grounds of his credentials. He's one of the most well-credentialed lawyers in the United States of America. You're not going to be able to challenge him on his ethics. There are no ethical problems. By all accounts, he's a tremendous guy, great dad, great husband, great colleague. And you're not even going to really be able to challenge him as being some sort of guy wildly out of the mainstream. I mean, this is a guy who's solidly within the mainstream of conservative jurisprudence. So what do you do? What you do is you whip up hysteria. You try to recast conservative jurisprudence as extremist, to try to recast the mainstream of conservative jurisprudence as extremist. And when I say conservative jurisprudence, I mean originalist jurisprudence as extremist. And so you've already seen this. Like, Terry McAuliffe has tweeted out that millions of lives were at stake with a Kavanaugh nomination. The Women's March said thousands of women will die. A coalition of Yale students and alumni and faculty signed a letter that says people will die if Kavanaugh gets the nomination or is confirmed after his nomination. I mean, just absolutely hysterical stuff. One person tweeted out, a national editor, I believe, for the Daily Beast, tweeted out that contraception could be banned by Kavanaugh. All of this stuff is sort of designed to whip up a lot of fear, to whip up a lot of hysteria with people who should know better. And there's no indication it'll actually work to stop his nomination, but there's every indication they'll continue to try, and there's every indication that it will continue to, you know, further inflame and polarize the American electorate.
David French is a constitutional law attorney. He previously served as senior counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice for the Alliance Defending Freedom, and he's senior writer for National Review. You can read his columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. David, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., it's This Week in Pop American Christianity with Chris Rosebro, and we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
How was school today, kids?
Crazy! Hector's charioteer got hit by a stone, and his eyes fell out into the dust before him there at his feet.
Sounds like Patroclus was being hot-tempered, rude, and quarrelsome again.
He always is. Dad, what's for supper?
I don't know yet. Supper is such a problem.
If it's a problem, you can use the scientific method to figure it out.
Problem? We want supper. Hypothesis? I think Dad will make tacos.
Actually, I was thinking about spaghetti.
Tacos or spaghetti?
False dichotomy.
Is this the after-school conversation of your dreams? Registration is now open for the 2018-19 school year at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois, the only classical Lutheran school in the St. Louis area.
Hey, Dad, how did my violin practice sound?
Kiddo, it sounded epic.
Learn more at school.stpaulhamel.org. School.stpaulhamel.org.